From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Alex Stone had always been obsessed by magic, ever since he was little. But it wasn't until he studied physics at grad school that he made the connection between magic and science. Stone says you can learn a lot about the human brain by studying those moments when it gets tricked by an illusion. He's written a book that explores his love of magic and the science of deception. And in it, he explains that what distinguishes a good magician is their ability to divert an audience's attention, and not just that, but manipulate their expectations. Being a magician, he says, gives you this heightened state of awareness, this sixth sense. It's the thing, he says, that keeps him interested in magic. Today in the program, Alex Stone will join us to talk about his book. It's called Fooling Houdini. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Alex Stone has always been obsessed with magic. One year, his accountant was surprised to learn that he had spent more money on magic than food or rent. When he studied physics at college later, he made this connection between magic and science, and he's written a book that explores both. It's an affectionate portrait of the magic subculture. It's also part memoir. In the book, Stone says studying magic leads you to ponder some of life's deepest mysteries, which is why he says the world of magic is filled with scientists and the world of science is filled with magicians. His book is called Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind, and Alex Stone is joining us today to talk about it. Alex Stone is a science writer. He's written for Harper's, for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, among others. He also has a master's degree in physics from Columbia University, and he's joining us today from the Radio Foundation in New York City. Alex Stone, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for inviting me on.
I wanted to start with your father. He's a man you describe in the book as a – it's a weird way to start, right? He's a man you describe in the book as
– it's going to be a 45-minute session, right?
Right, sorry. You describe him in the book as this dyed-in-the-wool skeptic, didn't have a lot of interest. I mean, he wasn't into sports or camping, certainly not religion. But you say even the simplest magic trick would light up his face. What was it about magic, do you figure, that your father loved?
I don't know, but he's still like that. Exactly like you said, he wasn't a religious guy. We didn't do a lot of the typical father-son stuff. Ball game. I don't think we've ever been to a sports game together. And he was an atheist, so he never went to church or anything or temple. I don't think we ever went camping. Maybe we fished once. But yeah, magic, I'd show him a trick and he would just love it. And the thing about it that always kind of struck me as odd is that he didn't want to know how they were done. You know, some people can't stand not knowing. And he's a scientist. He's devoted his entire life to figuring stuff out. And yet he would plug his ears if I tried to – he would literally cover up his ears if I tried to explain a trick to him. So I don't know. Maybe it's because of the way that it provided a release or a respite from this world of logic and empiricism. I think, you know, like a lot of people, he enjoys being fooled because it takes you back to what it was like when you were a kid.
Yeah.
And everything was mysterious and filled with possibilities. But it's definitely how we bonded in many ways. He would take me to the magic store on Saturdays where, you know, it was this kind of magic novelty store with like fake vomit and x-ray glasses. And then the clerks would demonstrate the tricks for you. So it was like getting a free show. And that was like a big, big, big treat for me. And then years later when I competed in the Magic Olympics, he was in the crowd cheering me on. So, yeah.
So I think I understand from reading the book how you think about magic now, you know, as a journalist and as a grown up. But what was it about magic, do you think, that you loved as a kid? And are the experiences different? Is the way you think about it different?
I think it is a little bit different. I mean, I think on one level, the constant thread is that magic lets you experience this temporary mystery and suspension of logic. It's a controlled way of experiencing a loss of control. And I think that that appeals to everyone, no matter how old they are. But when I was a kid, I was drawn to the more classic magic tricks, the stage illusions, the Copperfields. And I didn't really know a lot about the deeper philosophical and scientific principles at play. I also didn't know that there was this vast subculture of people who practiced magic, who competed in tournaments, who held conventions, who had secret societies with these bizarre rituals. And so that was all something I discovered later in adulthood, as embarrassing as that sounds. And yes, as a science writer and as someone with a background and an interest in science, I was pleasantly surprised to learn how many connections, sometimes very deep connections, there were between magic and science. And that's something that I only really came to appreciate and understand later. So I think now I see how magic is tied into these other areas, how magic is a way of teaching us about the human mind. And maybe I wouldn't have continued to be, I mean, maybe I would have kept doing, I probably would have kept doing magic no matter what, but I think that that is probably what really hooked me in the end and kept me fascinated was that there's all these really cool ways in which magic teaches us about how we see things, how we remember things, how our attention works, and this and the insights that we gain into human perception and how we create a narrative of perception based on what information is delivered to our brains by our senses is something that is beyond magic and really applies to everyone and how we experience the world on a daily basis.
Earlier, I described the book as a memoir, and I'm wondering if you think I got that right. I mean, I haven't really seen the book described as a memoir, but it seems like that to me. I mean, it is very, really very personal.
Oh, you're right. It's a memoir. I don't know. You could call it an intellectual memoir, but that feels a little pretentious sounding. It's a memoir. Yeah, it's a story. I mean, ultimately, I wanted to tell a story. I wanted it to read like a novel, actually, because I think the best kind of nonfiction reads like that, although reality doesn't always conform to the artifice and structure of fiction. But
did you figure it would be that personal right from the start, that I've just got to bare my soul to really get at this?
It wasn't perfectly calculated that way, but I think any time – this wasn't just an exercise in participatory journalism. It wasn't Plimptonian lark kind of thing. Right. I'm going to play for the Giants or whatever. And not that there's anything wrong with that. I love that kind of journalism. But this is something that I'd had a personal attachment to long before I'd ever gotten the crazy idea of trying to write about it. So I think it's inevitable. And I think that had I not put myself into it, it would have been dishonest. Mm. And soulless in a way, because it's something that I was attached to on a personal level and that I love, but also kind of know is silly and geeky at the same time. It was a way that I connected to my father. It was a way that I sort of negotiated social situations. It's how I, met my girlfriend. So to not put that in there. Even though it seems personal at times and was hard because it's hard to, it makes you feel vulnerable to talk about that kind of stuff. Mm. I think I kind of felt that it would be dishonest if I didn't. And at times I would hold back and, I'd show it to my friends or something and they'd say, you really need to insert yourself more into this because it's, and also because, the other side of that is from a more journalistic standpoint, whenever you're exploring a strange subculture. The audience, or the readers, I should say, are experiencing it through your eyes. You're the Virgil character. Yeah. And so I think the more you can give them a sense of how you feel and why you care about this subject, then the more is at stake for them. So there's that too.
What I liked too is that, the book is about this, as you said, this really eccentric subculture, and these are really earnest people. And I think some, some could write it in a kind of more teasing way, but the book isn't cheap in that way. I mean, you have this real regard, because you're one of them, I guess. I think a love letter is how you describe the book at some point.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I definitely didn't want it to come off as snarky or mean. Because I do have a lot of affection for this world, and I like magic, and I love doing magic. And the goal of the book was not, making fun of weirdos. It was, look how cool this thing is. this crazy world. Yes, it's weird. At times it's hilarious, sometimes unintentionally hilarious and weird and geeky and eccentric. But there's also beauty in it, and we learn a lot from it. And it's this crazy world that no one or the vast majority of people don't even know exists. And you can learn a lot from it. And there's something meaningful to be gained by looking at this world. So I didn't I think when you write about magic, you have to have a sense of humor. Yeah. Maybe other people, some magicians will disagree. They want it to be treated with the utmost gravity and seriousness. I love magic, but I also recognize that it's kind of geeky and kind of silly on some level. Let's be honest. that doesn't mean it can't also be really cool and have lots of neat ideas in it, you know, like a lot of things. So I wanted to you know, I mean, I think there's a sort of self-deprecating tone to it also at times. But in the end, yeah, it's a loving portrait of this world because it's something that I did, I mean, that I was involved in and into and passionate about way before I decided to bring it to the page.
Yeah. There's this theme in the book that comes up time and time again. It's about perceptions. It's about how our perceptions, you know, our mind has this limitation in terms of how we perceive things and how magic, what's great about magic is it gets that. It understands that perception has a limitation and it kind of exploits that. That's a running theme throughout the book.
Yeah, I mean, if that's really one of the central like take-home messages that I think maybe a lot of people don't know and understand. I mean, maybe intuitively, but it's rather deep. Magic works in large measure by exploiting these innate cognitive mechanisms that govern how we see the world. Yeah. And it turns out that our perception of reality is filled with all these gaps, these lapses. And, you know, for obvious reasons, we're not aware of the things that we don't notice. But we don't notice a lot. Our brains evolved to function in a certain way. We're great, for instance, at paying attention to one thing while ignoring subsidiary distractions. We're good at making patterns out of things, at building a network of assumptions and then using that to negotiate a complex world by categorizing things. You know, our memories work in certain ways and that by reconstructing our reality from bits and pieces of information, which at times, you know, lacks a certain amount of fidelity. So there are all these gaps in our awareness, and these are things that we experience every day of our lives, whether we're driving in a car or watching a movie. And magic games these things. It hacks into the brain. It gets inside these little wormholes in our brains. And even the simplest tricks, which is one of the things I love about it, even just a simple coin vanish where you pretend to put a coin in your hand but you really palm it out, is, for instance, exploiting a lag in how your brain perceives motion. You know, the brain cells are still firing for a split second after the coin is palmed away, so you see an after image of the coin in the hand. So, you know, even if you know how it's done, it still looks baffling. You still see the coin in there because your brain tricks you. And this means or it suggests that our perception of reality lags behind reality. And that has pretty deep consequences because it means that, you know, reality and how we perceive it aren't in sync. And when you begin to unpack this and really look at it, you realize, wow, a lot of what we think we know, a lot of what we perceive may in fact be a weird kind of illusion, a fabrication constructed by our brains. And, well, I don't know, that's kind of wild.
Well, the thing about it also, which you take note of in the book, is that magicians kind of, once they practice, they get it. I mean, they have a way of understanding that. I mean, you say doing magic gives you a kind of sixth sense, a kind of heightened sense of awareness. And that made me wonder, like, do you use that in other parts of your life? Like, are you a better writer, a better journalist? Are you a better, you know, boyfriend because you pay a certain kind of attention? Or are you only paying attention to certain things? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think the answer is that you can use some of these techniques in lots of contexts. So the answer on some level is yes. In subtle ways, you learn. Well, let me give you, like, an example.
Yeah.
One of the things – and the thing is there's research on a lot of this stuff too. So it's not confined just to magic. But for instance, like, one of the things that magicians are experts at is manipulating people's choices.
Yeah.
You know, you pick a card and you think, you know, you exercise free will, but no, the magician was holding the strings. And getting you to think that you've exercised free will. And there's an entire literature on this, on so-called choice blindness, on how we, in retrospect, in hindsight, we tend to think we've acted more freely than we have. And we're very bad, it turns out, about evaluating the consequences of our choices. For instance, just to give a quick example, there was this one classic study where they showed subjects two photographs of faces. And they said, pick the one you find more attractive. And they picked one of them. And then they gave them the photograph that supposedly they'd picked and asked them to justify their choice. But in fact, they pulled a switch and they gave them the other one, the less attractive face, using, incidentally, a move that was invented by this magician Hofsenzer. It was actually a magic trick.
That's right.
They found remarkably that most people didn't notice that the faces had been switched. And when asked to justify their choices, they gave these remarkably detailed post hoc explanations. Oh, the chin was pointier. Oh, I like the eyes. You know, such as a classic example of how, wow, like we really don't always know, you know, how our choices influenced outcomes.
Yeah.
And magicians are great about this. They use wording, subtleties in actions and to direct our choices. How something is phrased, for instance, can really affect how you choose. You know, you're more likely to – if you ask someone, you know, are you feeling happy, they're more likely to rate themselves as happy as if you say, are you feeling unhappy, you know?
Yeah.
And there's literature on this as well. So I think it clues you into that. It also clues you into how people focus on things. And misdirection is something really universal. I mean, it happens all the time. We're really limited into how much we can focus on. So you get an eye for what people notice and how distractions work and how you can – and what kinds of things are sub-threshold, will fall beneath the threshold. You also get an instinct for what people remember. This is something that never ceases to amaze me, is how people remember magic tricks. I mean, magic tricks are just – ripe for creating false memories. I mean,
yeah.
People remember crazy things all the time. Like people will walk up to me, oh, I saw this guy do this trick, and they'll describe a trick that I know. But there's one key detail that's just completely wrong. And, oh, I never told him the card. I was just thinking of it the whole time.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of it. You know, crazy things that are impossible. So you learn that kind of thing and, you know, how you can emphasize or through suggestion alone get people to remember different things. And, yeah, I mean, this is useful in relationships and business and teaching and whatnot. Sometimes there's an element of guilt that one feels in kind of exploiting these tricks, but certainly you can use them in any kind of context because they're basic perceptual ploys, you know, and perception is reality.
Yeah.
And that's what it really comes – I think it clues you into. And I mean, how people remember things and how they perceive things is often very different from how things – objectively are. And so when you internalize that notion, then you realize it's much more about, you know, manipulating someone's perception can be as powerful as changing the exterior circumstances that they think they're, you know, perceiving. That's not very well said, but you know what I mean.
But what else is great about the book is that you have, you know, these people who I think you describe some of them as pasty male virgins who have this, you know, have this great sense of awareness. Yeah, right. And maybe it's an unfair cliche, but it doesn't seem like they always have a great sense of self-awareness, you know, like the caftans and the ponytails and stuff like that. So it's give and take. I mean, it's really, it's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of aesthetic issues involved in magic and style. There's a lot of fashion don'ts and style problems. I think overall, like an MTV makeover might serve magic well. I don't know why it's so many of the 80s outfits and the hair and the capes and the kimonos and the – I don't know about that.
But it's great. I have to say it's great. I mean it's such a – and getting into that subculture is really interesting. I mean, which sort of leads us to the Magic Olympics. And I want to get to that story actually when we get back from a break. Alex Stone is with us. His book is called Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. Ha, 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 ha. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer and amateur magician, or professional. I'm not sure. Are you amateur or you've done both?
Well, I have done paid gigs, yeah. My share of them, but I've never made my living by doing magic. Yeah. So I think maybe amateur is a slightly better characterization. I'm primarily a writer.
His book is called Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind. So I want to, in the book you write about this experience you had in 2006. It was at the Magic Olympics. It's this major competition, takes place every 3 years. And 2006 is the year that you competed. It was in Stockholm. Set this up for us, if you would, because this is a really daunting task for you. You're performing in front of some of the greats.
Yeah, right. So for those who don't know, every 3 years, magicians hold this tournament. It's the World Championships of Magic, and sometimes magicians call it the Magic Olympics. And it really is like the Olympics. It's every 3 years instead of every four. But there are events, and you perform in front of judges, and you get, like scores. And they get first, second, thirds, and people stand on the, three-tiered podiums, and different countries send different people to represent them.
Wait, you stand on a podium? Really?
At the end, yeah, give the ceremony. I mean, there's an opening ceremony with a procession of flags, just like in, the members of countries walk across the stage with their flags, and it's very formal.
Wow.
It's actually organized by this UN-like consortium called the FISM, which is, it's French. It's like the Fédération Internationale de Société Magique or something like that. Right. And it's, in order to compete, you have to belong to one of the magic societies sanctioned by the foundation, and you have to get the approval from the president of your member society. And the U.S. has three FISM-sanctioned societies, the Society of American Magicians, of which I'm a member or was a member, the IBM, the International Brotherhood of Magicians, and the Academy of Magical Arts. So anyway, I, in a fit of hubris back in 2006, decided to compete at the Magic Olympics, having never competed in a magic tournament before. The crazy thing is, I mean, in retrospect, it was really the height of delusion. I actually thought that I stood a chance.
Yeah.
And in hindsight, this was a bit like someone who plays miniature golf on the weekends deciding to take on Tiger Woods,
Right.
I jog on the treadmill, hey, Usain Bolt, come on, let's go for it. It was, really silly. And I was these are the best magicians from all over the world. People who've been working on their 8-minute acts for 5, 6, 7 years, just on that. And you perform in front of hundreds of people, thousands of people, and a panel of judges, all of whom are really top-notch magicians. And so I was just outclassed, and I just got creamed.
Well, wait. I mean, it was a fiasco. I mean,
oh my goodness.
They have this thing where they call red lighting, where being gonged, really, right?
So literally, exactly. Yeah. If within the first 3 minutes, if you suck so bad within the first 3 minutes of your act that the judges deem you to be beneath the minimum skill level required of everyone, they illuminate a red lamp of shame. At which point you immediately have to leave the stage, stop your act right in the middle of your act, and just go home. It's over. And at the 2006 Magic Olympics in Stockholm, that horrible, disgraceful fate fell on one person, and that was me.
That was you. Well, it's funny you're laughing about it now.
But
it was anguish, humiliation.
Oh, man, it was rough.
It was really rough.
Yeah, I mean, being humiliated in front of 1,000 people, many of them children, was not easy. And people, I remember people afterwards, couples would walk up to me arm in arm and be like, I'm so sorry. Like as if I'd just been diagnosed with cancer or something. I'll never forget this one guy, a Swedish mentalist. He walked up to me and he said, don't worry about it. In 20 years, you'll look back and laugh. And then he said something which was even a little weirder. He said, if it had been an Asian guy, he probably would stop doing magic forever because the disgrace would have been so huge. And I was just like, what? Really? And he's like, but you're American. You keep going.
So yeah, but it's so – I mean you kind of went off the grid, you say, after all of that. I mean the effect was really powerful. You talk about
– Yeah, definitely. After that, I was just like, okay, I'm done. Yeah. No more magic. So I'm like, you know – so I didn't do it for a while because, yeah, I was just so sad. And I didn't want to go to my magic meetings or anything like that because I thought people were just going to laugh at me. So I fell off the grid for a while. I hung up my spurs. But after like a while, after some time, maybe about almost a year, I started getting back into it. I felt the tug of magic pulling me back. And I guess I decided – and this is the story that – part of the story that Fooling Houdini tells. Yeah. I decided I was going to start over and really try to learn magic from the ground up and get a real sense of it, which meant, you know – learning the moves and sleights and getting a mentor and going to magic schools, but then also understanding magic at its foundations, the psychology of it, the history of it, and how it ties into all these other things like physics and math and psychology, and also things like gambling and crime and religion as well. So yeah, that's sort of where the book, where the story I tell in Fooling Houdini starts, with this horrible, terrible defeat, and then, you know, getting back into it and trying to really learn it, you know, the right way and become an expert of some kind, and to really try to understand it and achieve some level of mastery, and however that's judged.
Talk about I was really interested in this. Is it Di Vernon?
Yeah, Di Vernon, the great. I mean, Di Vernon was like the Einstein of sleight of hand. Yeah. He was the greatest sleight of hand expert of the 20th century, perhaps of all time, incredibly influential, just transformed what's known as close-up magic, which is like magic that's done at close range, right under your, it's the magic that happens under your nose with cards and coins and cups and balls and spoons and rings and stuff like that.
Close-up magic, right? Yeah.
Yeah, close-up magic, sleight of hand stuff, as opposed to like stage illusions, like, you know, sawing a lady in half and floating and stuff like that, making a Harley disappear.
Yeah, and he comes up with what they call in the business the perfect trick. I mean, he actually fools Houdini.
Yeah, so one of the great stories about Di Vernon is that, Houdini, at the height of his career, made a very famous boast where he said that no one could fool him with a trick if he saw it performed three times. And, in magic, you're typically not supposed to repeat a trick for the same audience because magic depends on surprise and misdirection, and it's harder to get away with those kinds of things twice. Once is a trick, twice is a lesson, is an old saying. For years, the challenge went unmet. And then one night at the Great Northern Hotel in Chicago, at a dinner held in Houdini's honor by the Society of American Magicians, of which he was president for a while, Di Vernon, somewhere around dessert, pulled out a deck of cards. They were aristocrats, that's known as his cards. And he executed a sequence in a trick that's known as the ambitious card. And the ambitious card is a classic routine wherein a sign card or an ace is placed somewhere in the middle of the deck or second from the top and repeatedly rises to the top of the deck. And according to the story, Di Vernon performed this trick no fewer than eight times before Houdini and his wife walked out in defeat. Di Vernon was since known as the man, he was known as the man who fooled Houdini. He would use that on his press materials. And he's also known as the professor. And what's interesting about this isn't just the story itself, but this ambitious card routine has become a classic. It's sometimes, like you said, called the perfect trick. And almost every magician knows a version, and magicians are continuously reinventing the effect, creating new versions and fooling each other with it. And in fact, a guy not too long ago won the Magic Olympics in card magic with a version of the ambitious card that he came up with that climaxes with the card rising to the top of a deck that's been wrapped in a coil of rope, like hogtied in rope, like a Houdini escape. The title of the book, Fooling Houdini, refers to this story of Vernon fooling Houdini, but more generally to this idea that magicians are continually engineering new ways to fool each other.
Yeah.
And that drives the art of magic forward. It propels the art constantly into new territory, and that's why they have these tournaments. A lot of people think magicians are unfoolable,
yeah.
But it's really not true at all. Magicians are always fooling each other and trying to come up with new ways to put one over on each other, and that's this gladiatorial spirit drives a lot of evolution in magic, and that's one of the cool things about it.
One of the things you write about, the story of how the good ones always have a mentor, someone who kind of watches mm-hmm. over them, kind of a master-apprentice sort of relationship, I guess. And yours became a guy by the name of Wesley James, who's a really fascinating character, hangs out in this broken-down pizzeria in New York. I guess he's always there. I'm not sure if he still is always there, but certainly when you—
On Saturdays, he's there, like, I mean, religiously.
Yeah.
He's like the neither rain nor, you know, it's like the Pope.
Right,
it's like,
right.
It's like he's— I mean, when he's always there. The only time he's not there is when there's this invitation-only convention upstate known as the 4F. He'll go to that. But aside from that, I mean, he will— like when it's closed sometimes on, you know, for holidays, I half expect to find him standing outside.
Yeah.
Smoking. Yeah.
How did you come up— so tell us more about Wesley James. I mean, you describe him as this eldest son of this airplane mechanic, grew up in pretty rough neighborhood in Brooklyn, gets this PhD from NYU. So you kind of have that connection, I guess. He's a science person. You have an affection for science as well. Talk about Wesley, if you would.
Yeah, he's a really, really interesting guy. He's been a kind of legend in the underground magic community for decades. Now he's in his early 70s and retired, but he was a professional magician for many years. But he also studied computer science back when the field was pretty much in his infancy, and he did some seminal work in the field. He's a very smart guy, and that's kind of how we bonded at first, is over science. Certainly not over my, you know, extensive expertise in magic. He knows everything. He's an encyclopedia of magic. And anytime you want to learn, you know, figure out, oh, who invented this move or what's the best way to do this, you go to Wes and you listen at his feet and he'll teach you a million different ways to do this or tell you the whole, you know, footnote the entire history of a move or whatnot. He's especially well-versed in gambling sleights and moves that can be used to cheat at cards. I first encountered him getting involved in the— – I would go to the magic store on the weekends, Tannen's, and hang out. The store itself is almost more of an institution or place, a meeting place than it is a store. I mean, they sell stuff, but it feels more like a place for people to get, like a hub of the magic community. And then I started to hang out with these people and jam or session, as I call it. And then afterwards, we're going to this pizzeria. And then I learned about this Saturday weekly gathering of magicians. It turns out that the tradition of these magicians meeting in secret on the weekends goes back almost like 100 years in New York. It's this old tradition. Vernon used to do the same thing. In fact, Wes James, trained with Vernon.
Yeah.
Vernon was one of his mentors, and he learned the ambitious card routine from Vernon. For years, he did Vernon's ambitious card. So this lovely tradition. Mm. So I started going there on Saturdays, and it became kind of a ritual for me as well, which in a way echoed the ritual that I goes back to my childhood when my dad would take me to the magic store on Saturdays. And the magic Saturdays kind of persisted, the magic Sabbath. Yeah. And then I would hang out with Wes, and he would teach me stuff, and I'd ask him questions, and he'd yell at me. And, he's a very smart guy. He's a little bit grumpy. I'm sure he'd cop to that.
Yeah.
And it's true. Like you said, there's the tradition of legacy in magic is very strong. And magicians often, because deception in magic is kind of still an oral tradition, passed on from master to apprentice. And it's in the U.S. it's less formal, but in other countries, like in Korea, for instance, in Japan and China, there really are formal schools where students train in apprenticeships under masters. And when they come to tournaments, you'll see them with their coaches, not unlike the Olympics. And even when people talk about magicians, they often use a language that's kind of like Homer. They say, oh, the Spanish master Juan Tamariz, whose teacher was Arturo de Ascanio, patriarch of Spanish close-up, you know, something like that. You know, it's very like Beowulf or something. And Lance Burton, for instance, who's a he won the Magic Olympics a long time ago, the Grand Prix, and he has this long-running show in Vegas, his own theater. He starts his show by talking about how he's the last in this royal magic dynasty that started long ago and was passed on to him through Alexander Herman and all these other people. So it's definitely a very dominant theme.
There's this story I wanted to ask you about. One day at the pizzeria, you had this trick that you had taught yourself, and you wanted Wes to see it. It was this what you call this one-handed cut, and so you show it to him, and he sort of chided you for it. He told you this, and this was something I wanted you to sort of explain, because he said that an open show of skill is deadly during a magic act. He said it gives the audience a reason not to believe.
Yeah, that's right. So Wes is definitely of the view, and incidentally, this was very much Vernon's philosophy as well, that in magic you should never show skill. You should never do any fancy moves. You should never do any flourishes or cuts that appear – that make you look skillful.
Yeah.
Wes's big thing is, I don't look like I'm doing anything. That's what he'll always say. I'm doing nothing, you know? You should basically handle the cards like anybody who just, you know, once maybe plays cards once in a while. Because if you show skill, then the audience thinks, oh, yeah, he's skillful. He's just using some sort of technique or dexterity or sleight of hand. And you don't want them to give – you don't want them to be suspicious. It raises suspicions.
Yeah.
It sets off their alarms. It makes them – it puts them on guard. So, you know, there can be no man behind the curtain. There can't even be a curtain.
Right.
You don't want any – and this is in distinction to, say, juggling, right? For instance, Wes told me about this story about how in juggling, you want to look as skillful as possible. And sometimes jugglers will intentionally drop a ball or a pin once during an act – to drive home that message that they're operating at the edge of their skill, at the highest level, and make it seem really dramatic. But in magic, that's juggler's logic, as Wes calls it. And magician's logic is different. You never want to mess up. You never want to show skill. You want everything to be hidden. And incidentally, this logic is very much in the tradition of gamblers and card hustlers. Because the same thing is true if you're at a gaming table. If you're going to cheat at a poker game, you sure don't want to start doing one-handed shuffles and flipping cards. You know, that's a surefire way to get backroomed quick. You know, you want to look like everybody else, like you're not doing anything. And that's very much the tradition that Vernon came up with. You know, he honed his skill as an underground card dens and seedy gambling joints. And Wes is very much in that tradition. Now, there's other traditions. There's other sides of magic that are very flourishy. There's even this new genre of magic that's come up in the last – this really started about 10 years ago and has become this huge – it's really exploded, especially online, known as extreme card manipulation. And they spell it with an X, right, like extreme sports. And it's all about – Google it. I mean, you should look it up. Look XCM up. I mean, you'll see these guys – these kids are amazing. They do these insanely complex and difficult cuts and flourishes, and they just look like – the cards are just breaking up into patterns and overlapping stocks, and it's amazing things. And some people, a lot of old school magicians will derisively call that juggling with cards. They say, oh, that's not magic, you know. Mm-hmm. And people like Wes, they hate that stuff. They think it's the antithesis of creating a magical atmosphere.
Alex Stone is with us. His book is called Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind. We need to take another break. We're back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Alex Stone. We're talking about his book, Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind. So I wanted to ask you about a card handler that you sought out, an amazing card cheat, I guess is how they call it. I mean, he's like the world's best. His name's Richard Turner.
Yeah. This guy is truly one of the most amazing people I've ever seen in my life. He is, like you said, a card cheat, or he describes himself as a card mechanic, which means he specializes in moves that you would use to cheat at cards. Things like false shuffles, false cuts, stacking the deck, dealing from the bottom or from the middle or second from the top. And Di Vernon, actually, no less an expert than Di Vernon, said he could do things with cards that no one in the world could do, that he was the best card manipulator he'd seen in his entire life. And, I mean, it's true. I've seen him many times. Actually, I'm going to see him again tonight for like the 20th time.
Wow.
In fact, he's giving a lecture in New York. But I've spent many hours watching him. And, you know, the world of magic is filled with a lot of hucksterism and, braggadocio, propaganda or one guy, Jeff McBride, calls fake lore. But Turner's the real deal. I mean, he is straight up the real deal. He can deal flushes from a shuffled deck. He can find the aces, can deal from the middle. And he can do these moves in such a way that it defies scrutiny. Even the expert casino pit bosses or the best magicians in the world can't tell what he's doing. You can tell him, 19 cards, and he can just reach over with one hand and grab exactly 19 cards off the top of the deck. But the most amazing thing about him is that he's blind. He's legally blind. So he does it all by feel. And he's developed his sense of touch to such a high level of acuity that the U.S. Playing Card Company, the world's largest playing card manufacturer, has hired him as their touch analyst, which means he basically does quality control for them. They send him decks of cards, batches of cards, and he feels them for any irregularities. He can tell if the paper is off by a small fraction of a millimeter. He can tell if the embossing has changed or if the ink is slightly more moist or if the chemical coating is slightly different. He was sought out by organized crime, New Jersey and Saudi Arabian, diamond merchants offered him millions of dollars to brace games in Sun City. At one point, a man from an organized crime syndicate offered to have anyone he wanted killed. He said he'd make it look like an accident. He said, "I can have your wife killed if you want." So I spent a lot of time with this guy, and it's interesting. For one, because what he's able to do is interesting, but it also led me to an investigation of things like neuroplasticity, how the brain, when we lose one sense, how our other senses rally to the task of compensating and become hyper aware, and this is something that's been studied. And one of the most curious things about it is that, blind people, it turns out, have more sensitive hearing. You know, the perfect pitch is twice as common among blind musicians as among non-blind musicians. That's why the best piano tuners are blind. They're able to distinguish subtle gradations in touch and texture that are far beyond anything seeing people can do. But what's really incredible is when they look into the brains, using fMRIs and stuff, of blind people who are executing, say, tactile, like reading braille, for instance, right? Like doing something with their hands, touching something. They find that the visual cortex, the part of your brain that processes vision, is what's active. And not only that, their performance on these tasks is directly proportional to the amount of activity in their visual cortex. Like how well they do depends on how much activity they're showing. So in a sense, it's like they're seeing with their fingers. And for a long time, neuroscientists didn't think that one major brain region could take over for another. That the visual cortex could process tactile sensations. And this is known as cross-modal plasticity. It's a relatively new discovery. I also spent some time looking at how tactile sensations can affect our behavior. It turns out that incidental tactile cues have a profound effect on how we think and feel. They've shown that waitresses who casually touch their customers on the shoulder get bigger tips and boost the restaurant's ratings as measured by exit surveys. Or that even the act of holding a warm glass can make you feel more generous towards other people and make people seem, make you more warm-hearted. They did a really cool study where they found that people sitting in hard, uncomfortable chairs drove a harder bargain when negotiating on the price of a new car than people who were sitting in soft, plushy chairs.
Yeah.
And this ties into this theory of embodied cognition, which is that on some level, our ability to understand and experience abstract emotional concepts is grounded in our ability to physicalize them and make them real. Maybe this is why people who have Botox injections in their frown muscles are slower at reading sad sentences than happy sentences, because in some ways to experience sadness, you have to actually be able to express it you know?
Yeah.
And so this is a tangent. Sorry.
No,
I'm
no,
going
no.
way off here.
No, no.
But this is some of the stuff that I thought of in Fooling Houdini. It's one of the tangents I went on in this.
Well, there's another great one where you go, meet up with the psychologist, Arian Mack.
Right.
She coined this term, inattentional blindness, which kind of, I wanted you to say something about that. You were talking earlier about how we tend to overestimate our powers of observation, but you actually went into the lab and did some studies, and I wanted you to mention that.
Right. So Arian Mack is a psychologist at the New School who did some of the earliest work on inattentional blindness, which is a form of cognitive blindness that occurs when we're distracted.
Yeah.
So it's different from, say, what Richard Turner has, which is he's got a problem with his macula, something wrong with the eye. Your brain doesn't process an image even if you see it. This is like why you shouldn't drive while talking on a cell phone. It's not because your hands are busy. It's because when your mind is occupied, you might not perceive a car or a motorcycle or a pedestrian in time to avoid an accident, even if the image enters your retina and goes down the optic nerve. And this has been verified, and it turns out hands-free devices are no safer, and it's because, again, it's your mind that's compromised, not your hands. Well, we did an experiment where we brought people into her lab, and I would distract them with a coin trick and steal their watches, take their watches off their wrists using sleight of hand techniques that are familiar to many magicians. And I mean, I'm not by any means great at this. There are magicians who specialize in this, who are so-called theatrical pickpockets, who bring people up on stage and just rob them blind. And it's like, that's the show. I'm okay at it. But we still, even someone with, even a rank amateur such as myself, we were able to basically fool like 80% of people. They had no idea that I'd stolen their watches. And then what I usually put the watch on my own wrist and then do a card trick. So they were looking at their own watch while I was doing this, and they still didn't notice. So this is a really – and again, this is the kind of thing you think, well, I never – I totally notice. But the truth is you don't. I didn't notice when – the first time I'd ever have my watch stolen by a guy at the magic store. And it's remarkable. Yeah, we tend to vastly overestimate our powers of observation because we don't tend to remember or notice the things that we don't notice. But there are these – huge yawning gaps in our awareness that result from the way our brains are able to pay attention, which is that we're great at focusing on one thing. And that's a signal virtue of the human brain. It's what got us from, cave paintings to iPhones, 50,000 years. But the downside of that, the flip side, is that you can literally be blind to things happening in the periphery of your attention.
You know, I wanted to ask you about – it seems like you discovered – you write about you put it aside – I mean, it was really humiliating in 2006 in the Magic Olympics. But you sort of dig your way back. You have this opportunity to perform in New York, and it works. And you talk about how you felt like that you had found for the first time the poetry in your magic. It was a term that you had heard and you were kind of you were back, and it seems like you discovered an important message. I mean, there's this idea of revisiting and recreating the conditions, it seems like, that you had experienced with magic as a child, the importance of play, the love
absolutely.
Of being fooled. It seems like that's an important – you kind of come back around to that idea in the book.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the thing about magic is it's supposed to be beautiful and fun. And I think for a while I got lost in the technical – part of it and the scientific part of it, which is all really interesting and important. But in the end, it's just supposed to bring you joy. It's also supposed to tell a story.
Yeah.
Like, really good magic tricks are interesting because – not just because they represent some violation of physical law, but because they're anchored to a symbolic logic. I think, for instance, why the ambitious card, the card rising to the top, is such a classic that continues to be popular through the ages is because it's a story of triumph over adversity. You know, no matter how hard you try to bury the card, it pops up like a Houdini escape. It's a Houdini escape told in miniature. And every great magic trick, is about telling a story. You know, there's a reason why if you make something disappear, you have to make it reappear, because disappearance is a metaphor for death in a way. Mm-hmm. It makes you uncomfortable. It creates tension. You have to bring it back. So I think in the end, while I'm never going to be at the level of the Magic Olympics or, the great pros or West James or Turner, I was able to find a happy medium where the tricks I was doing fit my personality.
Yeah.
And were fun and things that I enjoyed. And I think when you're having fun and when you're playing and more relaxed, regardless of whether it's magic or writing or music, it comes across and the audience is able to support you with their joy. One of the things that I've always found really interesting is if you tape a magic show and listen to the reactions, you know what the first thing, the most common reaction is? Laughter, right? You laugh. People laugh at magic.
Yeah.
More than ooh and ah and clapping, it's laughter. Why is that? Like, why is laughter the primary reflex? Like, what's funny about magic? And I think, well, answer. I think it's because I think the experience of magic is fundamentally a comic one. In the same way that jokes represent an inversion of social norms, you know, they rupture our expectations. They use surprise also.
Yeah.
Magic represents a whimsical playing of, you know, a whimsical toying with the laws of nature. I took a clown class. This is a whole other story, but the teacher said that the clown is the physical manifestation of the unsocialized self, and I think magic, to totally plagiarize this guy, is the physical manifestation of the dream self. Anyway, that's again. Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent here, but I think that's in terms of, you know, suspending reason. It's a way of just being a kid again and experiencing a world where everything is possible.
Alex Stone. His book is Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind. Joined us from New York City. Alex, thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our interns, Tim Slover and Matthew Martin. We have technical direction for Mike Anderson. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.